You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The company Signet Jewelers, which owns K Jewelers and Zales, told investors last month that sales of engagement rings are down so far this year. Company executives said that part of that is economic, higher inflation stopping would-be couples from purchasing expensive jewelry. And they say part of it is a ripple effect from the early days of the pandemic, when many single people weren't going on dates and meeting the partners they'd eventually proposed to. That's one company's view, not a detailed scientific study. But our relationship milestones often come with significant price tags that can bring harsh economic realities into our love lives. We're exploring the financial costs associated with love and romantic relationships at every stage, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What role have finances played in your relationships and key decisions? Have you delayed getting married or having kids, maybe, because of the costs? Have you found creative ways to save money in dating or marriage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the Vaughn Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community and Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's also faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me today.
Big picture, I think we like to think that love conquers all, but what effect, how big an effect do economic conditions and our personal finances have on these relationship milestones?
Yeah, this certainly couldn't be a less romantic topic, right? Good thing it's not Valentine's Day. But this is actually a topic that we spend a lot of time thinking about the role of individual finances and the role of larger economic circumstances in society and what role those play in the relationship decisions people make and the stresses that relationships experience. And by and large, we find that there's an association between these things across lots of different aspects of relationships, the partners we choose, whether or not we get married, whether or not our relationship is under stress, when and how we have children. So there's so many aspects to your question where we really do see connections between finances and relationships.
Something that's come up on conversations on the show here over the last few years is this idea of a marriage gap, or at least a long-term commitment gap, where people with college educations, higher salaries, more likely to find that long-term partner, people at lower socioeconomic levels getting less likely. Is that something you've seen?
Yeah, so we know that about two-thirds of people who have graduated college end up getting married, and that's compared to only about a quarter of people who stop schooling before graduating high school. So kind of looking at those ends of the, you know, educational credential spectrum, we see really big differences in marriage behavior. It's important that we don't equate that with finding a long-term partner, because one of the other trends that we've seen, especially over the last 40 years or so, are really big growth in what we call cohabitation, so living together outside of marriage. So people can find those long-term partnerships. Whether those last and whether they turn into marriage, though, can be a different question, and one that we do see a really big gap on based on education.
Now, we heard the jewelry company there blaming COVID in part on postponing relationship milestones, the dating, the engagement, the marriage for people. When you look back at the last few years over COVID, what impact do you see it having on our decisions to date and get married and things like that?
So I'd say, you know, what the company is claiming is not, it's not totally wrong. It's not totally the whole story. When there's a lot going on in the world, like financial turmoil of a recession or a pandemic, couples are more likely to delay making changes to their relationships. And that includes putting off marriage. It also includes delaying divorce. So during the early years of the pandemic, we saw about a 10% decline in marriage rates and divorce rates. So people sort of stomp the brakes, basically, when something big is going on and put off making those big decisions. That said, we also know that we've seen a long-term trend, not just during the pandemic, in people waiting to later ages to get married and a smaller proportion of the population being married. So we're seeing people being older and older when they do finally get married.
Do we have any idea what's driving that, either people not getting married or getting married later?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of factors that come together, and some of it does have to do with this starting premise, right, that we talked about it being really expensive to buy that engagement ring or have that wedding. So we do have these cultural ideas about what getting engaged or getting married should look like. And those have changed a lot over time. They've really ratcheted up. So we have this idea, I think, in our culture today that a big white fancy wedding dress and a large bridal party and a big reception, those are traditional things. And that's what a wedding should look like. So you have to have enough money to do those things. But that actually didn't become common until the last 50 years or so. Before that, people often had small weddings, sometimes just in their parents' living rooms. So as some of our cultural standards for what, you know, marriage should look like, what a wedding should look like, as those things ramp up, people often feel like they need to wait longer and longer in order to get married. So that's part of what's going on. The other thing I'd say is we have these changing views about what marriage represents. So Andrew Cherlin, who's a really well-known family sociologist, he talks about how marriage used to be seen as the cornerstone of adult life, that piece that gets laid down before the rest of the building gets constructed. But now we see it as like the capstone on our adult lives. It's that piece that you put on the end after you have everything else set in place. So that means you have to have your job set in place, your finances, maybe you've even bought a house. And it just takes longer then to be ready to meet our cultural ideas around what marriage should look like today than it did in the past.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison, looking at the economy, finances, and our relationship milestones. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Compare yourself to, say, your parents or grandparents' generation. Did you get married later? Why do you think that is? Are the costs leading you to delay doing something? Dating, finding someone, buying that engagement ring, buying that big fancy wedding, or did you economize on that? And hey, how about the cost of having kids? Have you considered that and maybe put off having kids in your own life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's talk about the cost of having kids and childcare and how that's affecting people's decisions. What do we know?
So we certainly know that's a cost that's risen a lot. Our childcare market, basically in Wisconsin, but in the country as a whole, it really doesn't work. So there's really high demand, not enough supply, really low wages, and the costs are too high. So it sort of doesn't work for anybody. And that certainly can affect the decisions that some people make. But it can also, rather than affecting people's decisions about having children, it can affect the decisions people make about whether or not partners work part-time, work split shift. So it can affect family life in a lot of different ways. I think we, you know, can connect the decisions people make around having kids back to those larger conversations we were having earlier about feeling like there's instability in the world, feeling like you want to have your feet firmly under you before you get started having children. So all of those larger factors around finances can affect some of the decisions people make too. And for those people who want to wait until after they're married to have kids, as the age when people get married gets older, the age at which people have children then gets older, and the sort of time frame in which you can have kids before it becomes harder to do so can get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, in a way, when I think back, Sarah, there's always some kind of instability in the world if you look back through history, and there's always some kind of uncertainty about our life stages, our careers. Are these changes being driven by economic changes, or are these cultural changes in the way we think of these institutions?
You're totally right. There's always been, you know, different sources of instability on a global level and a local level, but our ideas around what family life needs to look like have changed a lot. And so I think that cultural piece that you pointed to is really important. in family sociology, we talk about this idea of deinstitutionalization, which is this huge word. And basically it means marriage is just less of a guiding institution in our society than it used to be. In family life, there are fewer and less constraining social roles and social rules, like all wives must do this or all fathers do that. And what that can mean is there's a lot more freedom. There's a lot less stigma around having your family look or function differently than someone else's family. But it also means that life is harder to navigate because you have to figure it out yourself. There's not just the way that everybody does things. And so we've seen those really big changes in our cultural ideas and ideals around family life.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison, looking at the financial costs involved in our romantic relationships, the role that economics play in when and how we date, get married, have kids, and hoping you'll put a face on it, or at least a voice on it, at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your experiences, did you put off getting married maybe longer than, say, your parents' generation did? What drove that? Did you hold off on scheduling that wedding till you could afford something bigger? Did the costs of childcare weigh into your decision of when and whether even to have kids? Join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or were you like me and you economized and you got a $30 wedding ring and did in fact get married in your mother-in-law's living room? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. She's with us today to look at the role money plays in our love lives, from dating to marriage, even having kids. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role has money or finances played in your romantic life, or lack of same at some stages? Have finances influenced your decisions on when to get engaged or married or have kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have what I think is a funny story to tell. In my, you know, when I went to college, we stayed up late at night talking about philosophical things like marriage and family and money and careers and stuff. Well, I eventually went into a low-income ministry where I worked with poor people, and I met a really nice lady that I really liked, and I asked her to marry me. And she goes, "No, I wouldn't marry you. You don't have anything." I says, "Well, neither do you." And so we eventually didn't get married, but we stayed friends. But 30 years later, I found out neither one of us married, and we still don't have anything.
Jeff, thanks for the call. You know, Sarah, I think that question of, am I marrying a spouse who's going to make enough money on one side or the other, an eternal question and probably an issue these days, too.
Yeah, you know, what Jeff was speaking to, right, is this idea that what's okay in a dating partner might not be okay in a spouse. And so we see that people will do things like starting to cohabit together so that they can shore up their finances. But then we'll also see cohabitors saying they're putting off marriage because they're not financially ready for it. And what's so interesting there, right, is those people are already living together. So they're living together the same way they would be if they were married. But it's this cultural idea we have around what your relationship, what your finances should be like to make them marriage worthy. And when that bar is hard to reach, it can mean that people avoid taking those steps either short term or, like Jeff was saying, for the long term.
Jeff, thanks for being willing to share your story at 800-642-1234. You could join in and share your story of how you hit those milestones, whether money was a factor in who you dated, when you married, if you married, whether or not you had kids. Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, what are some of the biggest questions on your mind when it comes to these relationship milestones? As we have this post-COVID economy, what are some of the big unanswered things for you right now?
I think there's just a lot of really interesting trends that we're seeing. You know, as I was saying, we're seeing more people do family life in their own way, right? It's not just dictated by, you know, this is the one way to live a family life. And so we're seeing more variation in what that looks like. We're seeing more unmarried couples buy houses together. So about 1 in 10 home buyers recently were unmarried couples. That's a really serious form of financial and long-term commitment, right? You know, you have a 30-year mortgage. That's a long-term commitment to each other. We see more people having children together outside of marriage. So about 4 out of 10 births today are to unmarried people. That again is going to be a lifelong connection you have with this other person. So you can get divorced, but that's always going to be your kid's other parent. And so one of the things that we're interested in is understanding more about how people navigate and create family life when they have to figure it all out themselves, because we don't have those strict norms telling us this is how you have to be a family.
And something you just mentioned reminded me of something you said earlier, and this is something I've seen in my own extended family where people living together break up, keep living together because they can't afford to maintain two separate households. Again, I've seen this in my own extended family. Is that something we're seeing at large?
So we certainly hear those anecdotes. I think especially we'll hear it like in New York City, other really expensive cities where it's not possible to even find an apartment, you know, let alone live separately, that finances do drive these decisions. I know in some of my own research that we've seen that when people are living together and they do break up, they're more likely to get back together. So not moving out with each other sort of puts you in proximity, makes it more likely you're going to fall back into bed together at the very least, even if not, you know, reunite long term. And so these financial decisions and circumstances really do shape the trajectories of relationships. And, you know, we can also talk about how they shape the stressors that relationships are under, because that's another component of what goes into this this mix of finances influencing relationships.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kara is with us in Waukesha. Kara, hi. Are you there, Kara?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Yeah,
go ahead. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I kind of have something to add to it. I've got a partner that I've been living with for almost 10 years now, and we personally have made the decision not to get married simply for the fact that he had a harder time, you know, growing up, didn't have the best credit score, you know, in his young adult life, whereas I did have those resources available to me. So, you know, I actually went out, bought a house. We lived together under my mortgage, but we get a lot of pressure from the outside about, hey, you guys have been together. Why aren't you married yet? You know, when are you going to have kids, when it's really us making the decisions for ourselves financially not to get married because it's setting us up for success due to just one person having a better credit score than the other at this point.
And Kara, thank you for calling in and sharing that. Do you explain that to, you know, the family member who says, hey, when are you getting married? Or do you just kind of give them a quick short answer, a none of your business kind of deal?
Pretty conservative Christian background. So I guess, you know, living out of wedlock is not something that's smiled upon from my immediate family. Whereas from his family, he comes from a Latin American background, so they're much more comfortable with us living together under out of wedlock, whereas my family is, it's a sensitive subject that comes up at holidays a lot.
Kara, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sarah, there's that we're doing our family the way we want to, yet also facing, at least from one side of the family, some social pressure.
Yeah, and that really speaks to the way that we've seen a relatively rapid cultural change around this. And so you still have people who are more committed to those old cultural norms and people who are, you know, have moved on from being guided by those cultural norms. What Kara speaks to, right, is this issue around what does it mean for our finances to be united? And so, you know, when people get married, their credit scores do remain separate. So you don't take on your spouse's bad credit. But if you go to make purchases together and you're both putting your names on that car loan application or that mortgage application, then both of your credit scores are taken into account. So that's one of those times where joining finances can matter. There are other circumstances where getting married can be financially beneficial. So it can affect your access to your spouse's health insurance that they might have through an employer. It can be beneficial tax-wise for some couples. It can also be costly tax-wise for other couples, depending on what your earnings are like. And so there are lots of those individual decisions that couples need to make in considering how they're going to be together as a couple long-term and what that might mean for whether they come out ahead or face more financial struggles because of it.
Kara, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Halpern-Meekin, Vaughn Baskin Professor of Women, Family, and Community and Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She was with us today for a look at the ways finances and the economy impact our romantic relationships and key relationship milestones. There is still time for you to share your own story. Do you have a unique setup for your family, at least compared to maybe previous generations? If you're willing, love to hear what led to that decision. If you feel social pressure from friends, family members, and others to change things, let us know. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Governor Evers signed off on the state budget with some significant changes compared to what state lawmakers passed when it comes to things like schools and taxes. We'll find out what the next 2 years could look like in Wisconsin under the new plan. And as always, you can join in with your thoughts. Plus, it's Food Friday, and this is always fun, Meathead is back with us to fire up the grill, this time with a focus on delicious chicken recipes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. First, a new bill in the state legislature would guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and other state universities for the top 5% of all Wisconsin high school seniors. We have the bill's author on to give the details on how this could change college admissions, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the top students in each school's graduating class have this guaranteed access to UW-Madison and other UW system and technical college schools? How selective should state universities be when picking new undergrads? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jerry O'Connor is a Republican state assembly representative from the 52nd district in Fond du Lac. Representative O'Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you, Rob.
I gave a very basic version of what this proposed legislation would do. Could you spell it out for us a little more, please?
Well, let's go back and just understand where the initiative comes from. This isn't one generated by legislators. It's one generated from students, parents, and then school principals, specifically high school or administrators. They find themselves during the admissions time, when students are sending out their applications, and kids that are in the top 5%, kids that worked hard, some had natural abilities, and others like me just found you had to spend more time getting your grades up. But to that extent, they make their applications and find out that they're not accepted in our state university system. Primarily, this deals with UW-Madison as a flagship school, but it can include our other state universities around Wisconsin. And these kids come back sitting down with a principal or administrator saying, what did I do wrong? What could I have done different? Why was I not accepted? And you know what? You can debate that for a long time, but I really just come back to the simplicity of the scholastic review, the academic excellence, and believe that this group should be rewarded for their hard work and for their excellence in the classroom. If you go to the states of California, they are allowing in 10% of the top scholastic students. Texas is allowing 9%. We propose 5%. We're not trying to dictate all facets of admissions to the UW system, but we do believe it's necessary to raise the issue and provide that guarantee to our Wisconsin students.
I don't know how fine-grained this is at this point, but how would schools define their top 5%? Is this grade point or grade point in standardized tests, or do extracurriculars come into it? How do they say these are our top 5% this year?
Perfect question. The 5%, when we were discussing amongst ourselves how to craft this, I did work with our school administrator out of Fond du Lac, and that's the district I represent, Dr. Jeffrey Flagg. And our conclusion was different schools today are using different criteria. So to sit at the state level, and whether it's legislation or it's from DPI, and dictate to every school district what the criteria is, we stepped back and said, it will be up to the boards of the various schools to establish a scholastic criteria that fits their particular goal in educating their students. So that can be any combination of grade point average, SAT, ACT exam. They could have other scholastic requirements that would be factored in. So it is up to the local school district to define those boundaries, make those known to students in advance so, frankly, they knew what the target was, what their goal would be by the time they completed their schooling. So that's not state-controlled. That's locally controlled, and we really believe that's the best place for that to happen.
Talking to Representative Jerry O'Connor, looking at a plan that would say, hey, UW-Madison and other state higher education institutions, you got to take the top 5% of each graduating class from each high school around the state. Okay, some finer points here. How about the homeschoolers, Representative O'Connor?
Well, that was a question I brought up in a very early discussion. And what we looked at there is taking standardized tests such as SAT or ACTs. If they score in the top 5% of all Wisconsin high school students, then they would qualify.
What are your hopes for the state now, not just the individual students and families here? Do you think this could provide benefits for Wisconsin in general?
I think it does provide benefits, and I'm going to reverse the role. I've talked with – I'm on the College and Universities Committee for the State Assembly, and as different hearings we've had, I have talked with chancellors from different universities in Eau Claire and Oshkosh, and they have, frankly, bragging rights of saying, boy, you know, the number of students we bring from out of state, we're able to retain like 70% of that group upon graduation, and they get jobs in Wisconsin and become part of our community. And frankly, I'm thrilled with that. But at the same time, I know that's what other states are saying when our students don't get qualified or accepted into Wisconsin schools. They go to Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. They get accepted. And upon graduation, there's a 70% chance that's where they're going to remain. So we believe the long-term benefit is starting with taking our best and brightest coming out of high schools, securing their educations here in Wisconsin, and it will significantly increase the likelihood that upon graduation, they will become part of the Wisconsin fabric community and be a contributor long-term. And I think across the board, the state's going to benefit from that.
As you crunch the numbers, is there still going to be room for that student who is maybe, you know, in the top 7% of their class, wants to go to UW-Madison, can make a case for it? Is there still going to be room for in-state students who don't meet this 5% automatic acceptance requirement at a UW-Madison?
Yes, there will be. To give you an example, last year in 2022 in the fall, the university had over 26,000 freshman students that were admitted into the university. When we're talking about the top 5% of high school graduates, we're talking about somewhere in the range of 3,200 students give or take 50 students. So it's well within the capacity of the university to accept these. And even when we're saying this, I'll use the number 3,200, there are a number of that 3,200 that have been accepted. This bill really targets the balance of the 5% that were not accepted. And I, from direct testimony or stories from administrators and parents, we're talking about kids. One example, a young man was a three-sport star. He was number three in his scholastics, and he was the leading actor in a play. And he couldn't get accepted into our flagship university. He now goes to Minnesota, and the chances are when he graduates, he'll remain in Minnesota. That's the student that we're targeting, that we want to retain those students here in Wisconsin. But for the university, we want this to be a larger picture. Quite frankly, the Wisconsin taxpayers pick up two-thirds of K-12 education costs, and we pick up billions of dollars of spending for the university system. So to that extent, we believe the taxpayer should have some voice in what the outcome is and who qualifies to go into our schools. Without us putting forth an exaggerated number, it's just a statement. We believe this is the right thing to do.
Representative O'Connor, before I let you go, this is still in early days. What is your, at least your hopeful timeline for this idea?
We have had some discussion of having hearings in August and would introduce this legislation in September.
Representative O'Connor, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
That's Representative Jerry O'Connor, state lawmaker representing the 52nd Assembly District in Fond du Lac. He joined us for a look at his proposal to guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and other state schools to the top 5% of graduating seniors in each high school. Coming up, we'll get more analysis of the possible impact of that change, and you could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Is this something that would have affected you or your kid in that college admissions process? Do you have questions about how the admissions process works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about college admissions and a bill in the state legislature aimed to be proposed pretty soon. It would guarantee UW access for the top 5% of Wisconsin high school seniors in each high school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? What would you like to know about how UW admissions works? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for the invite, Rob. Happy to be here.
We just heard from Representative O'Connor laying out the case for this change. What kind of impact did you see this potentially having on admissions, especially at UW-Madison?
Well, it'd certainly control who has access to UW-Madison. I think the bill is marketed as, you know, giving more students in the state access to UW universities. But the reality is that institutions like Milwaukee and Green Bay and all the others already accept a majority of their applicants. And so this really is a UW-Madison mm-hmm. bill. And to put this in context, UW-Madison gets over 60,000 applications a year and accept less than 50% who apply. But they accept 60% of those from Wisconsin, 44% of the entering class is from Wisconsin. And there's already a board policy that requires at least 3,600 of UW's incoming class every year to come from the state of Wisconsin. So I don't necessarily see right now that there is a lack of access to UW-Madison for graduates here. It's important to recognize that UW is a number 10 public institution in the United States, right? So it's selective because it admits the best and brightest and brings those students from to the state from across the world. So the top 5% of Wisconsin is very different than the top 5% profile that UW is drawing from, right? So I think the representative mentioned Wisconsin, you know, we might use ACT scores or something to help define this top 5%. Well, Wisconsin's average ACT score is a 19 versus California's, that's a 27. And so UW is in kind of a different market for students, and it has the benefit of the state of bringing those students from across the world, but from across other states here to Wisconsin.
Part of the case, I think, was for predictability, saying, hey, if you meet your school's criteria, you're in. Whereas the perception, at least among some of Representative O'Connor's constituents, is it's a black box. We look good on paper. The kid looked good on paper. We don't know why they didn't get through the process. Is there something to be said for a transparent system like that?
Sure. I mean, I think it can be helpful for students and families and administrators to understand what makes a very, you know, an easy application to college. But at the same time, all of these boxes like GPA, ACT score, things like that, as we look across the state of Wisconsin, students who meet all of those boxes look very similar, right? And so having everyone that checks in each of these individual boxes doesn't necessarily always make for a very interesting or diverse incoming class. And I think the rationale for this bill, though, suggests that even if these things were predictable, that the decision for these students is UW-Madison or bust, right? That they're going to come to UW-Madison. If they don't get in, then they're not going to go, you know, to college, or that they're going to go to Minnesota or something, right? So it seems like a better avenue than trying to just guarantee admission and control kind of who's admitted to the state flagship is to work to keep more states in state, more students in state by investing in our other institutions, right? So we kind of talked about the California 9% plan. Well, California doesn't have trouble with students leaving because they have such strong institutions across the board, right? Six of the UCs are in the top 10. And so we could work and use state money to build up our other UW system schools so that it's not UW-Madison or bust, it's Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nan is with us in Madison. Nan, hello.
Hi. So I'm following this conversation, but I wonder why exactly would universities balk at the top 5% idea, and what exactly do universities get out of being exclusive? Thank you.
Nan, thanks for the call. And Taylor, I don't know that UW system or UW-Madison have taken a position on this proposal at this stage. But in general, what do universities, especially the more selective ones, see as pros and cons of this kind of idea?
Sure. And so I'll just also start off by saying that I'm just speaking in my capacity as a researcher and not on behalf of UW or any opinions from UW or the system. But I don't think that institutions are necessarily against having broader ways to bring students into institutions of higher ed. But the reality also is that UW can only support so many students every year, right? So if higher, larger incoming classes are coming in, that means the institution also needs to take in more money to help those students succeed, to give them a quality a college experience. And what we've just seen in the legislature is the legislature instead cutting UW's budget kind of in the same time that we see this proposal for guaranteed admission of additional students that would make this class even larger.
Thanks for that call, Nan, at 800-642-1234. Talk about college admissions with Taylor Odell, assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Just heard from a state lawmaker about an idea that would say, hey, top 5% of each graduating class in each district around the state, you're automatically in at UW-Madison and other UW system schools. Still time for you to check in on that idea at 800-642-1234. Taylor, you touched on the idea of diverse student bodies. An argument I've seen for this idea, when it's been presented in other states in the past, is, okay, hey, you know, we're racially segregated in some ways in this country. There's class segregation by county, by district. So maybe by saying, hey, everybody, every district is going to get a certain percentage of their students in here, this is a way to increase diversity. What do we know about how that actually works out in practice?
Yeah, theoretically, that does make a ton of sense. And the best evidence we can look at is to Texas, which has probably the most famous plan that just looks like this, right? The Texas top 10% plan. And we're now 26 or so years since they started operating that. And because of the size of, you know, the top 10% in Texas, UT Austin, their flagship, has a special carve out where they only have to admit, you know, the top 6% or something like that. But in reality, nothing really changed in Texas. So there was slightly more urban, slightly more rural students enrolling in Texas colleges, but really no change in race, ethnicity, or other factors that have persisted over time. And I have some colleagues that evaluated the policy, and they kind of concluded that these benefits were likely overstated, right? And they kind of stopped short in terms of like what people were hoping that this would ultimately achieve. And even with this level of predictability, right, like folks in Texas are still upset because maybe you're in the top 7% of your quote unquote really great high school and someone's in the top 5% of their quote unquote really bad high school. And so there are always going to be these differences in, you know, qualifications of applicants over time. And so this 5% rule wouldn't necessarily address everyone's concern.
Another idea I saw in an argument in favor of this kind of idea is it cuts down on the notion of school shopping. So a parent saying, hey, we know this school sends a lot of kids to the selective university. We're going to get our kid into that high school, maybe abandon this one that doesn't do as well. And whether that target school is a public, a charter, or a private, or whatever, maybe that takes fewer resources out of those schools that are losing students in that scenario. Is there enough research to see if that's something that has actually changed under this kind of system?
Yeah, I mean, I think schools are going to respond, schools and institutions as they start recruiting students are going to respond to this in really different ways. I think the reality and the fact that UW-Madison welcomes students from every single county across the state kind of doesn't suggest that we have these such high levels of geographic, you know, segregation, who has access to UW-Madison specifically, or that folks are really making such important decisions on where they're sending their students in hopes that they're ultimately admitted. But yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to see how this plays out, particularly if we're able to follow what it looks like in other states.
Briefly, a huge issue with just a minute or so left, U.S. Supreme Court ended college affirmative action policies, saying, hey, schools, you can't use race as a direct factor in admissions. What are you watching for next as campuses react to that?
Yeah, so this is a very narrow decision. It doesn't say that colleges can't consider race. What it says is that, you know, race has to be used in this very defined way. It kind of says nothing should be prohibited. You know, universities aren't prohibited in considering race. Students could, you know, discuss how it affects their life, whether through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. But what we're going to be watching is how lawyers and institutions respond to this and how they ultimately interpret the decision in the impact of their own practices. What I'm concerned about, though, is kind of many states that seem to be putting the cart before the horse here, like Missouri and Kentucky, and I've heard some proposals in Wisconsin, trying to extend this to other things like statewide scholarships for racially minoritized students or things like that, saying that, you know, this ruling applies to those things as well. And so this is a very narrow ruling on admissions. And so we need to figure out what that looks like, I think, before we push forward and try and dismantle some other things.
Taylor, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
That's Taylor Odle, an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at a proposed change to UW admissions that would guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and all of the UW system schools for the top 5% of each Wisconsin high school's graduating class. That's still in the early stages in the state legislature.